And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to Rates and Barrels, presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. Derek Van Riper here with Eno Saris. It is Monday, July 19th. Eno, I saw a picture that you were at the beach, but it was cold because you warned me about this as a soon-to-be Bay Area resident. The weather at the beach in certain parts of the peninsula, it's not the 85-degree scorching day that many of us are accustomed to when we go to the beach.
Yeah, I think it was pushing 59 when I took that picture.
In July. That's so bizarre.
Yeah. I mean, the key is, and the problem is, that around 2, if the fog is going to burn off, it does. And so then it gets to about 65. On nice days, it gets to 70, 75 sometimes even out there. But the problem is that everybody sort of knows that. So it gets really crowded at 2. And with kids, sometimes we're just like, hey, let's just go early and be cold.
Yeah, you can't swim, but you can at least go to the beach and play in the sand.
The kids were digging around in the sand, yeah. And the dogs really enjoy it, even though we can't let them off leash because they're not that great. So we have to kind of run along with them, but they really enjoy just the different sensory stuff. So yeah, it was a good day.
They're a work in progress. They're good boys. They're learning to become good boys. That's what I would say. Yeah. Right? They're trying.
Yeah. You saw firsthand what it's like. And oh my gosh, it's happening. It's white behind you. You can see you're already packing.
The teardown has begun. Possessions are making their way into friends and family's homes, giving things away as much as we possibly can, donating stuff. And I've kind of danced around this on a bunch of episodes. I am moving to the Bay Area. My wife got a job out there. So I'm leaving Wisconsin. I've lived here since I was in eighth grade. So it's been a long time. I've been either near Milwaukee or near Madison pretty much for all of my life at this point, at least all of the years I can remember for the most part. So it's going to be strange to leave. Actually, leaving in 2 weeks already. Yeah, in two weeks, I'll be partway to California already. Happens to be the Bay Area, so Eno and I will be pretty close and probably get to do some more fun like live events and different things we've hinted at before. So definitely exciting times, lots of change for me, and things will keep disappearing out of the backdrop if you're watching on YouTube. as you miss things, leave a comment for the items that you miss the most from the backdrop, and maybe they will reappear someday. If they hold a lot of value in your heart, maybe I will find room for them in my car. No guarantees, though, because I think it's going to be a tricky process.
I want this to be just like this gradual process of the things behind you just being walked off by random people, and you're still podcasting to the last second. Like, and somebody takes the whole set, and you're like out in a field.
It would be pretty funny to see that happen. I can imagine my father-in-law just deconstructing the entire apartment while I record. And yeah. Like, oh, well, I didn't know that was actually something that would move. That door, he had to move it to get a treadmill out of here. It'd be like the beginning scene when Schitt's Creek, when they're having all their things repossessed. It would probably look a little bit like that with all the items just vanishing yeah. into the background. But lots to get to on this episode, and some history actually to be made on Tuesday. Some really exciting stuff happening for the Orioles-Rays game. This game's going to be broadcast on YouTube. It's a 7:10 Eastern first pitch. Melanie Newman, who does play-by-play for the Orioles radio network, is going to be the play-by-play announcer for that game. Sarah Langs, who we've heard on several of the Athletic podcasts from MLB.com, she's going to be the in-booth analyst. And then Alana Rizzo, who's been a on-field reporter for the Dodgers in the past. She currently works at MLB Network. I think she appears on High Heat on a regular basis. She's going to be the field reporter for the game. And then Heidi Watney and Lauren Gardner are going to anchor the pre- and post-game shows. So an awesome all-female crew. First time in Major League history that it's happening. And you know, the winds of progress are slow, but it's great to see things like this coming together.
Yeah, it is really cool. I met Melanie Newman. It must have been like a winter meetings or something a long time ago. She was working for Round Rock, I think, at the time, maybe announcing their games. And so I've followed her career along closely and support her. Sarah Langs has been sort of exploded onto the scene with her great sense of numbers and her really like her impressively fast ability to sort of call upon different sort of numbers and research. I cannot do things that fast. I've been like, oh, let me look this thing up. Like this seems, and then she tweets it.
Yes, you might recall back in October when we were doing the playoff shows at night, there's probably no more than two shows out of 20 that went by where we didn't have a tweet from Sarah Langs because she was so good at pulling really good information very quickly. And absolutely, as you said, just a really great crew up and down. And yeah, I think I met Melanie in the Fall League one year. She was covering some of the Diamondbacks prospects.
That must be it. It must have been the Fall League. That's it.
The Fall League's awesome. It's such a tight-knit circle. If you sit in the press box for a game, you meet everybody because there's about four to five people at most there. And you're kind of like, so why are you here?
Actually, that works in the stands, too, because there's only about 50 people in the stands.
Yeah. What brings you to the Fall League? Yeah. So a great pitching matchup for that game on Tuesday, too. It's John Means against Shane McClanahan. And again, it's on YouTube, so you don't have to have an MLB TV subscription to watch it. 7:10 Eastern first pitch. And I think there was a great story that Britt wrote 2 years ago. Melanie was calling games for the Salem Red Sox, and her and Susie Cool worked together on about 30-plus games that year. And I think that was the first time a two female booth had called games in the minor leagues together, too. So more history being made this week.
There's also an interesting thing here going on. Like, I'm sure somebody will bring up, like, oh, they didn't play. And, like, most booths have a former player in them. But it's a little bit like coaching, I think, where I don't think that the main skill is playing, you know what I mean? Like
really not.
Like when you like the main skill for a coach is coaching. This may sound just stupid, but like the main skill for a coach is coaching. I think in other sports, like everyone's totally fine with that. You know, like yes, like Jason Kidd and Steve Nash are trying to be coaches, but there are plenty of coaches in the NBA and in the NFL. I mean, just look at some of their sizes.
Andy Reid, great NFL player, right?
Yeah, right.
Kurt Rambis.
Yeah, I think for the most part, in other sports, they're a little bit more like okay with the idea that like coaching is the main skill, not necessarily playing. And I think that's actually true of the booth, because I think the main skills are analysis and storytelling. You know, those are the two keys. And I think the best announcers and the best announcers, I think, spend time in the clubhouse getting to know the players and are like, oh, I was just talking to him the other day about Bobby Blah, right? The best analysis is quick and tells a good story and doesn't get you bogged down in the details. And Sarah Langs does that. And Melanie Newman's a great storyteller. So I just wanted to sort of make that point about how I'm not saying that, you know, that players can't be great storytellers and some of them connect with modern day players and tell good stories. But I don't think that it's a requirement that you have played professional baseball to be that person in the booth.
Yeah, it is not a prerequisite to being a great analyst and to adding color to a game and making the game more exciting. It's a lot of time to fill when you think about broadcasting a baseball game start to finish. It's like 3 to 3.5 hours every single day. If you don't tell interesting stories, if you don't bring interesting information, you will fall on your face. There are so many booths out there that you listen to and you're just like, wow, you guys fell a little short. That will not be the case on Tuesday. They're going to do a great job. That's a great crew that was put together for that game. The main topics on today's show, we had a bunch of questions trickling in, as we often do, and I'm so appreciative of the quality of the questions that we get here. I would say that at least half of the emails we get are written like as questions that could go directly onto the rundown, and most of the other half can be pretty quickly modified, or they're at least a thought starter for us to take a topic and turn it into something that we can talk about for a little while. And one of the main questions I wanted to get to is one that came in from Bill, and boiling it down, it was basically, you know, what's on the rubric for grading pitchers for the future? And he was asking in the context of playing for next year in a keeper or dynasty league. But I think this applies to just about every type of league, because if you're looking to pick a pitcher up for the stretch run or make a trade for a pitcher for the rest of the season, you're probably in many cases looking for someone who hasn't maxed out in value yet. Like, sure, you might be in a position in a keeper or dynasty league where you can throw some prospects at somebody and get back a top end guy. You can go out and you can go get Brandon Woodruff or Walker Buehler in a trade. But more often than not, you're trying to get somebody who hasn't fully popped just yet. And I think we need to kind of drill into what's different about the rubric for the long-term pitchers. This was on my mind over the weekend anyway, because I wrote about Jesus Luzardo for a little bit. He is struggling right now at AAA, and I wrote him up and suggested he's still a very good long-term trade target, a guy that you would actually want to put on your teams in keeper and dynasty leagues if you're playing for the future, and someone that I would expect to have a lot of on my rosters and redraft leagues in 2022, because, you know, barring a great finish to this season, Luzardo will cost less on draft day next season than he did throughout this draft season. And the main thing that drew me to Luzardo is the number of pitches that he throws. He throws four pitches and he mixes them all pretty effectively. We're talking about four pitches that he throws about 20% of the time or more each. That's pretty rare for a guy that young. And I think that's one of the traits that I'd be most excited about in the absence of, you know, stuff and command numbers that we get for guys that have debuted. It's kind of a mix. Like, for guys that have debuted, you get a peek under the hood. You get to see a little bit of what's actually going on. For guys that haven't, or guys that have made very few starts, it becomes a little bit more difficult, and you have to find some other factors that you want to seek out as you look for these pitchers.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, I don't value pitching prospects very highly. And so when it comes to minor league ones, I would say that almost any reason would be enough for me to pick them off the wire, because there are different ways for pitchers to be good, right? If you focus too intently on one rubric, you're going to miss other types of pitchers that are good. So I would say, like, if a pitcher pops at you for any reason, they're interesting. So if they are even like Alec Mills, and have, that's a major league version, but like, have, if you see like a 60 command on a pitcher, right? And good numbers, they're all going to have good numbers, right? In the minor leagues. I mean, Luzardo's having a little trouble right now, but most of these pitchers are going to have good numbers in minor leagues. It's going to be like, why do I pick this guy up over this guy? And I would just say, look for something that looks elite. So if they have 60 command, pick them up. If they have a 60 fastball, pick them up. If they have four pitches that are above 50 or something, pick them up in terms of those scouting grades. So that's my answer for the minor leagues, because it's very different once I get to the major leagues. Yeah, then I'm looking for, although in a similar way, I'm looking for something to pop. So I'm looking for an elite command number or elite stuff number. You know, I'm looking for something, because they're not gonna come up fully formed. It's very rare. So the reason I love Zach Gallen and Julio Urias so much is they came up and had great stuff and command numbers, have had great numbers while pitching, and I think will have good careers. They're already, you've seen some injury here or there with them. I thought they would be mostly clean slate guys, but injury comes for everyone, I guess. But the point is, you're going to have to choose. You're not always going to have these perfect command and stuff numbers. And so I would say a pitcher becomes interesting as soon as they do something interesting, you know, as something pops, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think for Lizardo, just to run with that example a little bit further, the only thing that gave me some pause is that both the stuff and the location plus numbers, both this year and last year, are pretty average. They're not bad, but they're nothing was standing out in those metrics. So how much wiggle room do you have when you see results like that? Again, we're still talking about a relatively small body of work for Lizardo, even throughout his time in the minor leagues because of the injuries he's had. He's thrown a lot fewer innings in the last 5 years than people realize. How much can you look at the stuff and location numbers to this point from Lizardo and pull down the ceiling a bit? Because even if the previous ceiling was possible SP2, there's a long way to go from that ceiling to, he's a back-end guy. Like, he could be a middle rotation guy. Or, yeah, with the velo bump he'd get on his fastball as a reliever and the secondaries he could choose from, he could be an absolutely filthy reliever. And I think there's still plenty of reason for the A's to try continuing to develop him as a starter a while longer before they even go down that road. But how much did the numbers from him to this point give you pause about where his ceiling truly is?
Yeah, I would. It's a great point to come back to Lizardo, because I do think he does have that. He has one thing that he does really well that makes him interesting. It's the fastball velocity.
Plenty of elo.
Sitting 96 from the left is pretty decent, and that I think sometimes is good enough. I mean, I once picked up Garrett Richards for one of his best seasons early on, when because he had opportunity and velocity, and I think both of those things are there for Lizardo. So I will continue to watch him with great interest, because the stuff numbers don't tell a good story. But also, I feel like, you know, if you put him in driveline or put him in the right lab and coaxed some better shapes out of his pitches, he's shown the ability to spin it. He's shown the ability to have a good changeup. So I think I would get him in the lab and be like, we're going to work on a cutter and a slow curve, and we're gonna put instead of this slurve that you have going, we're gonna try and put some distance between these two, and to give you two breaking balls, and that's what I would work on with him, and I think he could probably do it. So there could be like a new Jesus Lizardo who has a better stuff plus number because he's changed the shapes on his pitches, but it all started because he's 96 and can spin it a little bit. So.
Yeah, and I wonder if that's just a transformation that has to happen over a winter as opposed to something he's going to pick up during his time in the minors. I mean, he could come back and give them good innings, but it may take several weeks of reshaping those pitches before he's going to be the guy we want him to be.
He also may have to go outside of the organization and do what I heard a few minor league prospects say at the Futures game, quote-unquote, take his career into his own hands.
Yep, we might be at that point for him, but definitely on my list of guys that I'm interested in the long run.
But I think Velo, I mean, you have a list of some names here on the rundown.
Yeah, I got Michael Kopech, which I think is pretty obvious. Like, if because he's an injury away from getting that chance for the White Sox. Like, they pretty clearly could just bump him into the rotation if they had the need to do it. I think Nate Pearson and Spencer Howard are still, like, they're always stuck together in my mind. I think it's because they've missed a lot of time with injuries. They both throw hard. Howard's arsenal is probably a little deeper, so I think that's one thing that would lead me to want Howard more than Pearson.
But Pearson
if I
has
to
that
choose.
plus velo.
Right, and then you think about the park factors, like pitching in Philly is really tough, and so those guys are still on the radar for me. Like, if you're not playing for this year and you're looking to the future, obviously they're bouncing back and forth, like right around big league ready. They make some sense. I think one of the harder guys to figure out right now is Matt Manning, because this has not been a good start to his career. Home runs have been a problem for him at AAA. They've been a problem for him in the limited time he's been in the big leagues. He's had arm injuries. Is this the kind of guy you'd say, you know what, there's too much going wrong, I'm not actually going to trade for Matt Manning. I'm not going to buy low on him, long-term buy low on him, because I'm seeing too many red flags to actually feel good about it.
I mean, there were some red flags in his, what is it called, his progress through the minor leagues in terms of injury and results. And I think some people were already sort of pulling back, even on the scouting front, from having him as a, you know, like as a standout guy. You know, the Stuff Plus tells a story of, you know, a pretty good slider, pretty good changeup, but around league average, and then a bad fastball, pretty bad fastball. So I don't know. That's an oft told story. The one thing I would say that makes Matt Manning leap off the page for me is his home park. In his last start, he threw fewer fastballs too, and he got his overall Stuff Plus up to 96. So I think somebody with okay command and league average stuff in that ballpark is still interesting to me. So sometimes it can be he's a tiger. That is the thing that makes me interested in that.
Well, and I think maybe the shape of Tarek Skubal's early career numbers has given me a little more optimism with Manning than I might have otherwise. And Skubal's still having trouble keeping the ball in the park, even though he's pitching a lot better. I think over the last 2 months, Skubal's got a 3.55 ERA, a 1.26 whip, 65 Ks, and 50 and two-thirds innings. I mean, that's in a normal year, that's like good SP3, maybe even SP2 sort of production from Skubal. And he's given up 28 homers in 120 big league innings so far. That's a staggering home run rate for him. So, I mean, is this an organization we should trust with pitching? Is there a reason to trust them? And again, the park is obviously part of this too, but maybe that should factor into the analysis.
I think what Skubal and Mize are telling us is that their major league pitching coaching is better than their minor league pitching coaching. If you think about how Mize and Skubal arrived in the big leagues and then how their stuff looks now, they've both undergone fairly like large transitions, right?
Yeah, Skubal changed up his pitch mix a lot already.
So did Mize, man. I mean, Mize changed the shape on his fastball and changed the shape on his hard breaking ball and went to those more than his changeup. Like, he came up as like the guy with the amazing splitter, right? And then in his second year, he came back. He's like, no, I have a really great breaking ball and my four seam is actually good now. And I'm not going to be a sinker guy. So I would say their major league pitching coaching is good. Their home park is great, and Matt Manning still has some velo, and he's now working with the guys. So I'm not saying that Matt Manning is going to do the Mize Skubal. He probably seems the least one to bet on of the three, but
makes him the easiest to get, though.
Right, and there's a lot of those, like, what makes him interesting. He at least has that. That's my rubric. Does he do something interesting? And in this case, I would say being a Tiger, having velo, and working with that major league pitching coach are good enough things to make me interested.
The other name I was going to write up in the column this weekend that I chickened out because it was just about long-term buy lows, Jackson Coar, who continues to pitch well at AAA, but he had one of the most disastrous starts to a big league career that I can remember. I mean, just like literally could not get the ball into the catcher's mitt on every pitch. Like, that was the problem, right? He was bouncing stuff and he was all over the place. His AAA numbers are still good, and stuff in command numbers are not good, but
who's based this again? On
Jackson Coar. Like, I mean, he was so bad that I don't think you can even look at stuff in command because he only threw five innings and he wasn't like even throwing he wasn't executing pitches in the most literal sense. I'm tempted to say he's a pretty smart buy low because he continues to dominate AAA. Minor league results, I think, do carry some weight. And what's interesting to me about him, well, the opportunity. It's wide open. They have that need for pitching. So I think he gets a chance before the season's over and probably looks a lot better the second time around with the Royals once they give him that chance.
I think, again, here the thing that makes him interesting is pitches for the Royals. I mean, I think their pitching development is probably a little bit behind, at least the major league pitching coaching, because they're having some real difficulties in that pitching staff. They seem to have a type too. They're very heavy on the fastball slider guy, but Coar's best secondary is a changeup. He has 96. So I'm definitely interested in him. It is weird to see such poor command from a guy that, you know, only one time in the minor leagues had a walk rate that was worse than average. And that was his, like, A ball.
Yeah, so I think there's more good than bad in that profile for sure. So he makes the list for the podcast, even though he did not make the cut for the column. But any other names you could think of that are popping in a good way with the underlying numbers, but they don't necessarily have the surface results? Because that's usually when you get those clear sort of buying opportunities. I mean, I mentioned Pearson and Howard. Like, they're just so frustrating to this point. I thought we'd get a little more from both of those guys than we've received through the first half and change now of this season.
Sort by stuff. I like to do that. I like to start by stuff. Tanner Houck.
Yeah. A glue guy for Boston for sure.
Oh, and Sam Long, dude. I mean, this is... Sam Long would be interesting if he had stuff that was like a stuff number that was five lower. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He has a 114 stuff plus and pitches for San Francisco. Like, you've already got me. You know, mm-hmm. And he's coming back this week. Justin Dunn still interests me. I know that the numbers haven't looked good, but the stuff in command numbers underneath are good. And Seattle isn't quite the pitcher's park that I have in my head, I don't think. And I guess he has a 3.75 ERA, so maybe somebody's saying he already broke out, but I think there's plenty of people who look at the five walks per nine and say, this isn't going to work out. Command Plus says it's a league average command. So
I do like Dunn. As long as he gets healthy again, I'm in on Justin Dunn. Long is a great call because I think the lack of prospect pedigree, the fact that he's already 26 years old, those two things alone kept the interest down in him when he first came up. He's on the IL with a back injury right now, but I think he's going to give us good innings when he comes back. I think the Giants need him to provide good innings too. He's kind of an extra nice little piece to put into that rotation mix.
Yeah, yeah. Still love Austin Voth. Still love Christian Javier, although the command plus number is low and the team seems to be okay with having him as a reliever. They're treating him weirdly, I think. Still have some love for Jameson Taillon. But that's now we're getting old.
Yeah, we're definitely getting a little older here. I mean, I think the Javier thing is interesting because he'd be the other type of pitcher that fits. We're looking for something interesting, be that velo, above average pitches, above average command, right? You want something, some standout skill. Javier, I think, does have standout pitches, and he doesn't have the role right now. But even though... and I think the stuff numbers back this up, Luis Garcia is better than Christian Javier. Christian Javier might be good enough to stick as a starter when there is an opportunity. And those guys who are the next guy up, especially this time of year, this is a great time to trade for Christian Javier in a keeper or dynasty league, because if the winter goes by and we have injuries, something changes in that depth chart, and it becomes clear that he's going to be a starter going into next season, it will cost a lot more in February or March to go out and make a deal for him or to draft him than it will to just simply make that move in a long-term league for him right now. And I think he is their next option into that rotation if they lose anybody.
Yeah. And then there's the two Baileys, Falter and Ober, that have their... Well, Falter's having a harder time nailing that role down, but people don't believe in Ober. The thing that makes them both interesting is standout command. That's maybe not what people expect when they see Ober, who's like, you know, 7 feet tall. Both of them also have a little deception in the way they release the ball, like a lot of extension, basically. So, I think they're good to point out because they don't have prospect pedigree. They don't leap out the page on stuff or velocity, but they do something that can make them interesting.
Yeah, so hopefully that gives a nice general rubric for people out there in long-term leagues or even those just looking for undervalued arms potentially for the final part of the season. Saving money in FAB, always nice to do that if you can, or saving pieces in trade, also very helpful if you can pull that off.
It's funny. I just think of this. I had this one legendary year in Devil's Rejects where in the draft, so after we'd kept, you know, it's 20 teams, 28 keepers. So after we kept all those players in the draft, I drafted Dallas Keuchel, Carlos Carrasco, Jake Arrieta, and Garrett Richards. All in the sort of 600 to 700 range, all the year before they broke out. I mean, that was, they all had that, the next year, they all had great years. And I did them all, like somebody was like, well, what was the rubric or whatever? And I was like, well, Dallas Keuchel had a pitch mix change. I don't know if people remember, he used to throw a curveball and then he went to a slider, I think. And I could spot that in the results and with the pitch mix change, I was like, he's a lot better than his overall numbers suggest. Jake Arrieta and Garrett Richards, I said, well, these guys throw really hard and they both have opportunities. They both are going to go into the rotation. And then Carlos Carrasco was like, you know, this guy has multiple pitches, throws hard, and used to have prospect pedigree. And that was the rubric, really.
New orgs, too, I think, kind of factor in there. I mean, Carrasco getting out of Philly and going into Cleveland, and Arrieta back in the day leaving Baltimore and going to the Cubs. I mean,
new coaching, like just a new, you know, even if it's a new pitching coach on their own team, you know, I think new coaching is a big deal.
Yeah, and double the impact if you get the new coaching and pair it with an easier league and or improved park factors, which I think
like
was the
Jake
case
Arrieta.
For Arrieta, especially. Yeah, like all of the things got better for Arrieta.
Left
all
Baltimore?
At once.
Oh, he's interesting.
Thanks a lot for that question, Bill. It was a great thought starter for today's show.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
All right, you know, let's get to a few more of these questions. We have an inquiry about Max Scherzer, and the question comes from DT. DT writes, on his fantasy baseball rankings, Eno has Max Scherzer at number 4, which completely makes sense, except when you consider his stuff plus number, which is just average. Is there something about Scherzer's fastball and slider that stuff plus doesn't capture? Perhaps it's Mad Max breathing in some crazy mental energies to the ball. Thanks again for answering the fan questions, DT.
So Max Scherzer actually has a good stuff number now. We did an update to it, and it's kind of fascinating. We added spin efficiency as a feature. And the reason we're doing this is I think ideally you would break spin into two components. And then have some sort of idea of how much the ball spins horizontally and then how much it spins vertically. And if you did that, you might be able to find out about how different spins interact with each other, right? But we threw in spin efficiency as a proxy for that because spin efficiency is just... how much of the spin is captured in the movement. But I think it's mostly judged by vertical movement. So spin efficiency is a stat that points at the relationship between vertical and horizontal spin. I think you could almost... express it in spin axis, the same information. But any case, Spin Efficiency gave us Max Scherzer's slider as a standout pitch. So now with Spin Efficiency in there, Max Scherzer's slider is a 121 stuff plus slider, a very good slider. And I'm looking right now at the interaction, the feature interaction between the velocity on the slider and his spin efficiency. And there's a grouping of really good pitches that are hard sliders that are gyro sliders. That's basically what he throws, which is a pitch that doesn't, a slider that doesn't have a lot of movement, but has a fair amount of spin. And so it, the harder he throws that slider, the better it is. Which is interesting because he also has a cutter, but that's just the truth. So when I look at his Stuff Plus card now, I see four really great pitches, and the changeup that was supposed to be his bread and butter when he came up is his worst pitch now. But it's a 90 Stuff Plus, so it's still like a decent pitch. So what makes Max Scherzer good? We didn't give his slider enough credit because it's a gyro slider that doesn't move, quote unquote, as much as other sliders, and the spin isn't turned into movement. But it's still very good. I think what we're seeing for Max Scherzer's slider has good late movement, because if you throw a gyro slider that spins like a bullet and doesn't move a lot, as the sort of pitch as the arc of the pitch changes, right? Like when you throw it, it's going sort of it's going parallel to the ground, right? But as it approaches the plate, the pitch is now it takes on like a curve, right? Like it's going closer to the ground, and as that trajectory changes, the ball will capture more of the spin and move. So if you have a high spin pitch that's not moving at this trajectory, when it gets close to the plate and it's falling, the trajectory changes, and so therefore it'll capture some of that spin and move. So there is actually a scientific basis for the thing that players have been telling us has existed all along, which is late movement exists. I don't care what your stupid machine says. Late movement exists. And now we're like, oh, yes, look at this machine readout. He's right. Late movement exists. So I think that's Scherzer. Scherzer has a gyro slider that doesn't, quote-unquote, move a lot, but has late movement. And our recent update captured that. But he's also a guy that has four or five pitches, right? And telling the difference in just in numbers between Tyler Glasnow and Max Scherzer is very difficult, because you have your sort of two elite pitch guy. You know, he was better when he added the third pitch, but you have a guy, when you have a guy who has two elite pitches, Patrick Corbin, you know, when they have two elite pitches, how does that age? How does that look compared to a guy like Max Scherzer who has a lot of pitches? So I think if I'm betting on someone long-term and I want to like sign a pitcher in my dynasty league or something, I want them to have a lot of pitches. I don't want to sign Patrick Corbin. I'd rather sign Hyunjin Ryu. I don't really want to sign Tyler Glasnow long term. I'd rather sign the next Max Scherzer, Zach Gallen. You know, lots of pitches.
I mean, if you go back, and we've probably pulled this thread before, but the old scouting reports on Max Scherzer, like when he first entered professional baseball, a lot of them pointed to him being a reliever, I think in part because of his delivery. It's a very violent delivery with the head jerk. And I think people thought the command wasn't going to be good enough for him as a starter. I guess when you think about a guy like Glasnow, you'd also have to weigh the likelihood of him adding more pitches at this stage of his career. Is it possible that Glasnow eventually feels good with that third pitch, adds a fourth?
But it took so long, dude.
Right. And it's a tough thing to assume is going to happen. He can still be really good for a long time as is, but he won't be as good for as long a period of time if he doesn't develop that. And more likely than not, he won't develop that. But it's really interesting, just because Scherzer, just hearing you talk about this, the gyro slider, I always think of a cutter as a pitch that has mostly late movement, right? It mm-hmm. just it avoids the barrel because at the last second you get that little bit of horizontal movement and guys can't really square it up, but they swing and miss on it entirely. I kind of think the gyro slider just has more of like a late dropping movement as opposed to that. And it obviously could move horizontally too. It could move in both planes, but in my head, at least, that's how I'm sort of separating. I'm like, okay, a gyro slider has that same that last little bite, and that's what makes it so good. And it's interesting that that wasn't entirely captured previously. So, were there any other guys that you could think of that sort of popped because of that adjustment and how that was being measured?
Biggest stuff plus changes. Sam Long went from terrible to awesome. Flexen, Wood got better. Musgrove got worse. Let me see. Gyro slider, though. I think Stroman, maybe.
I just wonder how many of those guys have a propensity to induce a lot of weak contact, too. I would be curious to know how closely those things are tied together.
I do think that is part of it. And then one of the other changes we made to Stuff Plus when we made that change and put spin efficiency in was that we also split each of the events that it could predict. So instead of trying to sort of train the machine against run value and just ask the machine what produces the best outcomes, we asked the machine a little bit more specifically, like what produces strikeouts, what produces pop-ups, what produces this. And by doing that, we captured, I think, some more weak contact guys. So, weak contact guys that pop for me are Stroman, going from 77 stuff plus to 97. Sean Manaea went from 84 to 103 in the update. Alec Mills went down. Jordan Montgomery went from 80 to 97. So there are some weak contact guys in here that improved. Yeah, I don't know. The biggest nut for me to crack now is to figure out how to reward number of pitches. Because it's not obvious. You know, someone could manipulate their, they could have a better stuff number, but only have two pitches and therefore be, you know, not a great guy to bet on. So there has to be some way to do that. And I'm discussing that with Max right now. Any ideas, please. Please send them to us.
Rates and barrels at theathletic.com, at Enoceras on Twitter, at Derek Van Riper for me. You guys know the tags hopefully by now. Thanks a lot for that question, DT. We had a question come in about Chris Sale and expectations for him following Tommy John surgery. And I know Stuff Plus is still relatively pretty new. I'm just kind of curious how much you lose. And we've known for a long time, walk rates are usually higher for guys coming back from Tommy John, right? The control doesn't always come back right away. But what are the expectations for Sale once he rejoins the Red Sox rotation? This could be applied to any number of starters. I mean, if you assume a normal rehab assignment where a guy has all of his pitches and has velo at or near where he was pre-surgery, can he be himself right away, or is that an unreasonable sort of expectation?
We have some, you know, actual evidence, research that points to the adage that fastball velocity, fastball command is the thing that struggles in the first year. Coming off of Tommy John, like there's actual research out there that quote unquote proves that, or you know, at least underlines that as a true thing. So it's interesting. Like I think we've talked about Noah Syndergaard, Luis Severino, and Chris Sale all year in different capacities. It is interesting to say, which one would you have bet on to have the best recovery and to be the best in their first year? Because I think they're all great bets for next year. but somebody's going to give some value this year. And I would say this, Sale had the best fastball command going in.
Yes, even if you take some away, that still leaves him at a better point.
Yeah, but it is interesting to wonder if you take some away from the guy who depend, like Luis Severino was not good because of his fastball command. right?
Right, right.
So what if he comes back and his stuff is there and he's like, well, McCann's a little bit worse, but that was never my thing anyway. So I'm just still going to just throw it by people. Syndergaard could probably say the same thing, although he has sneaky good command. I don't know if people, like, he always rates it really highly by command plus. But I think, like, would it be like that much more detrimental to Sale because he's used to having the fastball command? I think Sale's the best bet of the three. I hope I thought that going in.
I think I was on Syndergaard because Sale was having some early setbacks back during draft season.
That's right.
Made me think that he might take the longest, and now it looks like he might actually get back.
But Syndergaard's had, you know, like hamstring type, you know, oblique type. Like, he's had other type injuries of just being a large human.
Mm-hmm.
Type injuries.
Yeah, the kind of like the Aaron Judge problems.
Yeah, so I'm not that surprised that he's had some issues coming back. But Chris Sale, like, seems super frail, you know, so he seems kind of breakable like a rubber band, but like a, you know, but
well, he's got the, you've described body types in the past as whippy. I would say, yeah. Chris Sale is the extreme of, this is a whippy body type.
That's true. And then Severino is more just sort of stocky. But I never liked Severino's mechanics. I try not to mechanic scout because I'm not a guru. I don't say terrible things about people when they're hurt. Oh, I wish they'd burn a W. that's why he broke his leg.
Yes, that's why he fell on the stairs carrying deer meat, because of the inverted W. I still think it's parody. I'm not gonna lie. I don't think it's a real account. I think it's a long con terrible, troll job.
Terrible joke, then.
No, but thanks a lot for that question, Mike. There's a question here about J.D. Davis, and it begins, I'm sick of arguing with my friend. J.D. Davis is a fine player, but how good is he really? We're arguing over the small sample size nature of his 577 BABIP in his injury-shortened 2021. As a result, I'm tempted to fade him closer to his 2020, showing a 247 average, which is the only year he carried a stabilized BABIP of 318. My counterpart argues his X-stats point to, in 2019, proof of concept. Well, I argue that 355 BABIP from that year is equally unsustainable in future seasons because he doesn't have Tim Anderson's athleticism. My question and theory with J.D. Davis is the sample. Does BABIP influence X-stats, or is a tangible proof of quality of contact that has no bearing on balls bouncing in the right places? Can a player like Davis with great hard hit metrics maintain a 350 BABIP year over year with a 51st percentile sprint speed? How do we balance a BABIP we don't trust with StatCast metrics that we love? Are we both right? Are we both wrong? Or are we just completely incapable of meeting in the middle? Thanks in advance. I might have to bet a 4-pack of Hen House on it. Jordy.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question, philosophical question almost. He hits the ball really hard. He barrels the ball well when he's healthy. I guess the question is, how unhealthy was he in 2020? And the answer is regress, regress, regress. So even if you're looking at, you know, his XBA, his expected batting average based on, you know, the angles and velocities he's hit is 338, according to StatCast. You know, even if you're looking at that, you wouldn't take 338 as his projection going forward, because you'd have to regress in that 2020. That existed. That happened. That 2018 happened. You know, these other plate appearances happened. So I think the answer is probably around the bat X, 319 going forward. Zips has him at 328 going forward. I would put the over-under on BABIP going forward at, like, 325.
Yeah. And, okay, so if he does that,
which is still high. I mean, the Major League BABIP is 290.
Then, what he's done so far might be a small notch above what he's likely to do going forward. His career numbers with a 333 BABIP are 275, 355, and 463 for the slash line. It's a 121 WRC plus, 23.9% K rate. I mean, if he's just a shade below that, he's probably a high 260s guy with a 340s OBP and a 450 or so slugging percentage.
Yeah.
That plays. Not a good defender, so that's part of the issue, is that he can lose some time.
Yeah, if you're talking real life, it's a little bit... if he's like a 115 WRC plus guy with bad defense, that should be playing corner outfield or first base. The average WRC plus at first place is like 105 or something. So now you're talking about a guy who's just barely above average in real life.
Yeah.
But in fantasy, he still qualifies at third base. Probably going to hit like 265, 270. I might push that batting average a little bit, but, you know, 10 homers. I mean, he's a great pickup right now if he's available to you.
Yeah, so to answer the one question, does BABIP influence X stats, or is a tangible proof of quality of contact that has no bearing on balls bouncing in the right places?
It's the other way around. Like your X stats, there is a skill in having a high BABIP. The skill is not only being fast, though. The skill is hitting the ball hard and spraying the ball around the park.
Right, and not hitting it into the shift. Like that's the key, right? Can you actually use the entire field and not just be pounding everything to one side of the field, because that changes a lot about your BABIP and your expected batting average and your overall offensive production.
And also just, you know, not only side-to-side angle, because he's a pull hitter, but up-down angle, you know, if you don't hit a lot of 40s or negative 40s in terms of launch angle, if you kind of stay in the right angles, and that's what you will see in barrel rate, but also something like dynamic hard hit rate that Alex Chamberlain has. You know, there are certain stats that capture that ability to kind of hit in the right angles a lot, and he seems to have that ability. Hitting it hard in the right angles. So yeah, you can run a higher BABIP if you have those skills. But we just don't project anybody to have a 355 BABIP. I don't think, like, I can look at the projections right now. I'll even use the BatX rest of season projections. So that's like, maybe someone is just spanking the ball super hard.
Vlad Jr. or Juan Soto could be close to that, just because the way they hit the ball, but that doesn't seem good.
It's not showing me, but I'll just do Steamer then. Steamer, I think, has BABIP.
And while you're pulling that, I mean, look at Davis's spray chart from 2019. That's power to all fields. That's every type of batted ball hit in just about every direction. So I think he's a very good hitter and a pretty poor defender, and I would love it if he found his way into the AL, or if universal DH happens. Then you're not worried about that anymore. I think he could hit enough to be a credible DH for several years. So I think JD Davis is actually good as a fantasy player. He is a good fantasy player. He is not quite as good of a real life player because of these limitations.
Well, I am surprised, but I've just discovered that none of the public facing projections on FanGraphs project out of BABIP.
They don't put it on the leaderboard, or they don't project it?
I'm sure they project it. I'm sorry if I didn't mean to say it that way.
They're on the player pages. Like, they're tucked in on the player page.
Oh, yeah, of course they are.
Like, so Davis is at 319 from the Bat X.
That's right, yeah. So who would you be... Who is like... all right, let's do it this way. Who's a major league leader in BABIP over the last 3 years? Who would you guess?
Major league leader in BABIP. Jeez, I think Tim Anderson, who was mentioned in the question, might be the leader.
He is, 395. And Moncada is second, 377. Turner is third. So there's a lot of speed there. Alec Baum, though, is fourth with 350. That's not a speed demon. Brian Reynolds is sixth, 347. Nelson Cruz is your almost JD Davis type, I think. Just a guy who hits the ball hard in the right angles.
Yeah, where's he at?
341, 11th. But let's look at Anderson because he has the highest one. 395 for his career, or for the last 3 years. And he's projected to have, oh, there you go, a 346. That's about the highest projected BABIP I've ever seen.
Yeah. Year over year, looking at that, it jumps off the page. I don't stare at BABIPs very often, but a 399, 383, 397 running through those last 3 years.
But there's very little in common between him and JD Davis.
Yeah, they're very different just in terms of the types of hitter that they are. I mean, Davis brings a lot of raw power and doesn't run nearly as well as Anderson runs.
Davis pulls the ball 48% of the time. Tim Anderson is our spray hitter. Tim Anderson pulls the ball 33% of the time, goes center 38, oppo 28. That's way more balanced. So Tim Anderson is our spray hitter that has wheels, and he's got a 346. JD Davis is our Nelson Cruz type. Let's look at Nelson Cruz.
I don't know why Davis is pulling the ball so much this year. It's a small sample because he hasn't played that much. His 2019 distribution is a lot better. A 38.4% pull rate, 37.8% up the middle, and 23.8% the other way.
That's what I think of him as a player.
Yeah.
The projected BABIP for Nelson Cruz is, by the Bat X, is 298, even though he holds like a 340 over the last 3 years.
Well, it's the cost of being very old in the big leagues.
Yeah, but so anyway, X-Stats are trying to describe the quality of contact and the type of player a player is, and different types of players will have different BABIPs. I just think that Davis is slightly closer to Nelson Cruz than he is to Tim Anderson. So I doubt, I wouldn't project his BABIP as high.
No, I don't think it's necessary to do that. But he could still be a very good player, even if he's in that 330 range or something instead. Doesn't have to be elevated up at 355 the way he was 2 years ago. But
or whatever it is now, 500.
Yeah, 556. Come on.
But also you have to move past just like, 556 BABIP, he is bad. I mean, no, he's good. He's just not this good.
Right. And I think hitting 307 back in that 2019 season, like that's probably about as good as it can get for him over a full season's worth of games. I think if you said, what's the best batting average season that JD Davis has left? I would say probably wouldn't go much higher than about 280. Yeah. And I'm expecting more like high 260s from him in a typical year. Good run production, good power, good lineup. And again, a perfect fit for them. If Universal DH is here to stay in 2022, that is good news for J.D. Davis. Thanks a lot for that question, Jordy. I don't know if we actually solved your argument, so maybe you guys should just buy a 4-pack and each drink 2 and just call it good. So maybe you're both right in some ways. Just share the beers and stop fighting, I think would be...
That's our professional advice.
It's usually it's kind of my advice to most things in life in general. Yeah. Just stop fighting with each other and have a beer and you'll feel
Doesn't
a
work
little
with the
bit
kids
better.
Yet.
Well, on that note, if you got questions for a future episode, send them our way. He's at Enoceris on Twitter. I'm at Derek Van Riper. The email address again, ratesandbarrels@theathletic.com. If you're enjoying this podcast on a platform that allows you to rate and review it, we'd really appreciate it if you took a moment to do that. Don't let the haters win. Hit the like button. If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to subscribe to the YouTube channel. That way you get notifications anytime new episodes are available. That is going to wrap things up for this episode of Rates and Barrels. We are back with you on Wednesday.
Thanks for listening.